Hello friends, I'm your host Chris Thrall. I'm a former Royal Marines Commando. I've adventured, for better and sometimes worse, across 80 countries on all 7 continents. Welcome to the Bought the T-Shirt podcast.
Mark, can we go straight into Who Dares Wins then?
Well, sure, whatever you, whichever way you want to go.
Yeah, let's go for that, because I know a lot of our viewers will be interested. I tried to get in the SAS and I failed because I was too hard. But, you know.
Yeah, I can see that about you. You've got, you know, it's your eyes, mate. You know what I mean? Immediately.
It's the one-inch punch that I perfected, or is it the double that I, that's what frightens people.
Yeah, well, it's that or the 1,000-yard stare. You've got to practice the old 1,000-yard glare.
That's just when I'm stoned.
Let me give you the background to this, because I'm sure some of your listeners will be interested or not. But anyway, I was doing a show in the West End called Evita, and I was playing Che Guevara. And I'd already met Lou. I met Lou up in Manchester when he was doing the Cuckoo Waltz. So we'd been sort of pals on and off. And we kept bumping into each other at do's in the West End. And during the day, my family, I come from a long line of military people. Going back to my great-grandfather, we served all over the world. My father and his three brothers all served in the Second World War. I grew up in it with a history of people serving the First World War, military medals and all kinds of stuff. So it was just a tradition in the family, but I'd gone into the music business and the entertainment industry, and I was, but as we all did in those days, everybody was, you know, wanted to do something, surf somewhere. All of my pals, all my mates were kind of involved. So we used to go regularly to the Brecon Beacons and run up and down the Penefan and all that kind of stuff. So we used to go up there and do that a lot. And I'd finish a show on a Saturday night and we'd drive out to Wales and go up and down the mountains and run around the mountains and come back and go back to the show on a Monday night. And anyway, I actually bumped into Lewis Collins in the Brecon Beacons. It's absolutely true story, in the middle of nowhere, with Tom Conti and a bunch of other people and Ian Sharp, the director of Who Dares Wins. And we literally bumped into each other in the middle of somewhere. And we got chatting. It was raining, of course. We just stayed there. I said, what are you doing up here? Why are you up here now? Because I knew he was involved with Ten Para at the time as well, which he passed, of course. He had his cherry berry. And he said, oh, I'm training for this film I'm going to do called Who Dares Wins. Ian's directing it. So I got chatting with Ian, literally in the Brecon Beacons. And he said, what are you doing? I said, I'm playing Che Guevara in Evita. He said, I'd love to come and see you. So Ian and Lou and their respective partners came to see Evita with me playing Jay. And afterwards, as we got towards more of the production of the film, Ian said, I'd love you to be in this film. I want you to play his character, one of the bad guys. So I said, okay, fine. So the last 6 to 8 weeks, I think it was 6 weeks, of me playing Shay in the West End, I would drive to Pinewood or wherever we were shooting, and we shot my segments in the film. And as I say, Lou and I remained friends all the way up to when I was doing Robin of Sherwood. We'd been pals a long time, and had quite a few adventures. So that's how it all came about. That was the reality why I got invited by Ian to be involved with the film.
Wow. Sorry, I was just going to get a picture of Che up there for our younger friends out there who might not have been Barrage by the T-shirts that we were growing up. I followed Che's story. You know, I followed it from Argentina to Cuba, down to, it was Bolivia he was executed in, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, it was, yes, he was offed, yes, sadly.
I think maybe we take that, Mark, as maybe a podcast for another day, because it's...
I'm happy to talk about, yeah, any of that. There's a whole show to be doing about just Evita in the background of that. I spent 4 years in that, in the West End.
Yeah, so. And I've been to Buenos Aires and been to Evita's mausoleum, is that the right word? The big concrete thing that they put families in?
Yeah.
But getting back to Who Dares Wins, so you know Lewis.
Yeah.
How did you you got to play, can we say the bad, I don't like to use the word bad guy, but I don't, yeah, that's what it is, right?
I was, don't forget, so I'm playing Shay. I had a beard and long curly hair. And I know it's weird now because you're going to go, what, did you once have hair? And I once had a head of curly hair. And so I looked very, very sort of Mediterranean-ish. So I was playing Shay Guevara. So I ended up playing Nazir and Robin and Sherwood. And that's also due to Ian Sharp. And he obviously looked at me and went, oh, he's going to play like a bad guy or one of the terrorists or something. So that's our cast because of the way basically I looked. And also I was obviously playing Shay. So I ended up playing one of the bad guys. And Lou was desperate to shoot me. That is absolutely true. He was all the way through the film. He was, I'm trying to have it rewritten so at the end I can shoot you, which then became a joke. But I was actually shot by a stuntman called Terry Forrestal, who was also in the Special Forces. And Forrestal died during a parachuting accident, as is a base jumping accident some years ago. But Terry was actually the person that shot me in the face. But Lou was desperate to do it, but he never did. He never got to shoot me.
Can we just go back there a sec? Did you say an SAS guy that died in a base jump?
Yeah, Terry Forrestal was a member of the regiment.
He wasn't that chap that was on a documentary on the television, was he?
I don't know. Which documentary are you referring
to? I was chatting the other day with one of my base jumping friends about this. So I'm not sure if it was Mike McCarthy. I can't quite remember.
Well, there was two. Tip Tipping was one guy. Tip Tipping was a guy that was killed in a parachuting accident.
Yeah, and I've had Andy Guest on the podcast who was in the Royal Marines freefall display team. And
right.
They were, I was asking them if they knew, I saw a documentary about 10 years ago, probably 15 years ago now, and it was an SAS guy parachuting up there in Norway where they jump off the cliffs in the yeah. base jump.
Yeah.
And he was turning to his mates and going, do you know, I don't quite feel right about it. You know, and it is a key sign of like, well, you shouldn't be throwing yourself, you know. Yeah. And of course, yeah, well, I say of course, but ultimately this chap died. And now that you mentioned it, I just wondered if it could be the same person.
Well, it might have been because what the case was followed for a couple of days, because what actually happened was he was brushed against the cliff face. He was forced against the cliff face by the wind, and he ended up on a ledge, and he'd already got two broken legs, Terry, from a previous stunt that went wrong on a motorbike. So he re-broke his legs. And so he was on this cliff face, but it was too windy to get a chopper in. So he was literally on this cliff face waiting to be rescued, but they couldn't get to him. And from what I understand, he either decided to get off the cliff and try and open his spare chute or whatever, or he fell off the cliff, whatever, he slipped off the cliff face and he very sadly was killed in the accident.
Oh, yes. It's that Teddy thing, isn't it? It's better to die being a, you know, living like a tiger than it is to live as a coward.
Teddy was a good stuntman. And, you know, as with all of these things, and I know plenty of people, Martin Grace, for instance, being a good pal of mine over the years, Martin Grace was also one of the best Bond stuntmen ever. He got injured quite seriously on a Bond film and broke his legs. You know, you want to go out shining. You don't want to go out, you know, with a whimper. And these guys understand risk, you know. And what I didn't understand about that was, and it does happen in this business a lot, you do a risky thing once and it works and you've got it in the can, hopefully. You've got it filmed. And then they'll go back, could you give us another one? And that is always when the accidents happen, is when you just go beyond that one thing of safety, and that is when, and it can sometimes be fatal.
And Terry was a stuntman?
Terry Forrestal, yeah.
Yeah, I'm just going to get a picture up. I've got one here of him throwing himself off a scaffold. I don't know if that's meant to be an explosion going off behind him. I'm guessing it is.
Probably. That's either Martin Grace or Terry Forrestal.
Yeah, anyway. Funnily enough, there's very few photos of him on the internet, which I suppose you expect from a stuntman because they're generally not supposed to be seen, are they? Or they're,
well,
they're
and or they hide their faces. You'll notice there's a lot of this going on, you know. Yes. You'll see who dares wins. In fact, Martin Grace was the double for Lewis Collins in Who Dares Wins. You'll see him a lot. We're in the scene where I get on the bus behind Lewis. There's a scene where Lou then gets off the bus and is almost run down by a car. But it's actually Martin Grace, his stunt double. And the other scene where he jumps onto the boat, where he runs and I'm chasing him on the motorbike and he jumps on the boat, that was also Martin Grace. So, you know, that's the connection there is between the stunt guys, Martin Grace and Terry and Lou.
And Martin Grace has done Indiana Jones, am I right?
Yeah, did everything. He
did a lot. Let's get a picture of him up. He's got a very quintessential English gentleman look, hasn't he?
Yeah, but he was Irish. Ah, God, no. Very Irish.
If there's anyone that puts their foot in their mouth, mate, that's me.
But don't worry about it.
Sorry, Ireland. There we go. But there he is. Brilliant. Brilliant. So, yes, yeah, so back to the film then. What's it like to know Lewis then? I was going to say, what's he like? But that's, I'm not into dishing dirt on people, but maybe there's some stuff people would like to know about the legendary side of his character, which I'm sure.
Lou passed away a few years ago, as you know, and I think he made an interesting decision for an actor in his life, and he'd done everything, you know. He'd been a big star with professionals, obviously, and he did Who Dares Wins, and then he did some other films afterwards, and he worked on films afterwards after Who Dares Wins, but I think he got to a point where he wanted to break the mold and go off in a different direction, so he went to California. And started a computer business. And I think he did a few bits and pieces here and there, and he did some fan conventions. But really, I think he became a family man. And he and Michelle have got the three sons, and he seemed very happy. I mean, even though we were pals for over a decade before he got married to Michelle, and we had lots of adventures and stuff, we got into all kinds of trouble. Once he'd done that, he kind of made himself a bit of a recluse. And I have been asked many times to write stuff for his various autobiographies that have been attempted. And I've always said to the writer, do you have Lewis's permission to do this? And they went, no. And I said, well, if you get Lewis's permission, I'm happy to tell you stories. And I said, but I won't if he doesn't want it. I mean, it's different if it's coming from me, because it's my personal impressions and experiences, and I'm free to talk about my experiences with him as a bloke. But I don't want to write or speculate about anything else about it, because I wouldn't want to be seen to be spreading. This just came up recently with an interview I did about him. You know, it's why anybody would think I would do that, I don't know. Now, Lou was a complex man, but actually in a way, simple man. He was very fun-loving. He was very full of jolly japes, and actually a master of comedic one-liners and timing. And I know people don't get that from him, probably in some of the work that he's done, but he was a very funny, fun-loving, you know, big softy, really. And I think he probably, like all of us do at some point proceedings, said, okay, well, let's find out if I could be a para. Let's find out. So he did do his full para training with Tem Para. The man that trained him is a personal friend of mine called John Newman, who was one para. And when they were up at Finchley, which I've slept on that drill hall floor once or twice, and Lou passed P Company, and he got through, and he got his Jerry Berry, and he got his wings. So I respect him for that. I respect anybody that's done any service, that's thrown themselves in or volunteer. I never have a bad word for anybody that's done that, unless they've been stupid, in which case then you just got to say, look, mate, you know, wind it in.
Mark,
you
can know, I just chip in here? I mean, no disrespect to anyone. It's just not who I want to be. But we did have a subscriber the other day. He said he didn't actually pass his jumps course. He I think injured his leg on the third jump, and the guy that was writing this knows the DS on the course, so the staff. I'm not trying to be controversial, I'm just trying to acknowledge the chap out there that said that he sounded like he knew what he's talking about, is what I'm trying to say. But
Well, ask him, this person, you can ask him if he knew Colour Sergeant John Newman, BEM. And I know from John that he did get his wings and he went back and completed the course and did the seven jumps. Yeah. Now, there may be some, as I've heard myself, I've heard everything, even people from my side of the business. I've had every story from, oh, Lou got beaten up in the Special Forces Club and was kicked, got the shit kicked out of him and all that and got thrown out on the street. I have asked people in the regiment, do you know this story? Have you ever heard a story about Lewis Collins getting beaten up in the Special Forces Club? Because this bloke said it, and I don't believe it because I don't think Lou's like that. And he said, I've asked people, and they've gone, never heard that story. But you can ask Rusty the story about him going to Hereford and them having a few jars in the bar, if you like, at Hereford, because that's a true story. I know that's a true story. So a lot of people have got stories about what they think they know about people. I can only tell you what I know. And so I was told by John Newman that he completed his course, he got his wings and he got his berry.
Yeah, and everybody knows if 22 SAS try to rough up Lewis Collins, he just turned around and beat them all up. I've seen the film.
See, you know, yeah. Lou could handle himself. Don't get me wrong. Lou could handle himself. Lou was very physical and he knew how to throw a punch. And he certainly wasn't backwards in coming forwards, you know. And like a lot of people, I'll just name drop because it's true. Ray Winston, all of these guys that have got that persona in their film career, doesn't mean they go out looking for trouble, but people go looking for them. People want to go, oh, I beat up Bodie in the pub, or I beat up Bodie in the club, or whatever. And suddenly from what may have been a bit of pushing and shoving and a bit of, you know, sharp words, turns up, oh, no, he got the shit kicked out of him. Well, I can tell you the same thing with Ray. Ray knows how to throw a punch. Ray boxed for England. So Ray knows how to throw a punch, right? Lou knew how to throw a punch. Now, he may well have got a bit leery and he may have been asked to leave. I don't know, but I've never come across anybody told me that they kicked the crap out of him. It's, you know, I kind of had the same thing a little bit, but it's usually just online chatter. People don't know you, you know what I mean? They assume they know you because they've seen you. But Lou, I'd not heard that myself.
Shall we just clear up then? Not that it's our job to, and again, not that I really care, but did he pass SAS selection? Is that the rumor is, friends at home, that Lou passed SAS selection, whether that be through the reserves, I'm guessing through the reserves, and then was denied a place in the regiment because of his fame?
Well, I think a lot of it comes from the misunderstanding of what that means. And so let me clear that up. First of all, he went on selection for 2-1 SAS, which is the reservist element, artist rifles. They're now a different role than what they did originally during this period. They had a different role in Europe than what they have now. But 2-1 SAS, he went on selection 4. And my understanding is he passed the first phase. It's like anything. It's like people think you become a member of the intelligence corps and they just hand you a Walther PPK in a tuxedo and say, off you go, you now speak German or something. Off, you know, it's not the way it works. Mechanically, what happened from Lou's own mouth to me was that he passed the first phase, which was probably the beacons phase, the physical phase and running up and down phase, because the next phase would have been jungle. He would have gone to Belize and he would have then gone through a resistance to interrogation phase, which I don't think he got up to. I think he got up to the first physical phase and he passed that. And that's when they realized that having Bodie, you know, if he ever did actually, he couldn't really fulfill the role because he would have been, he was too high profile. He told me that himself. And he said that one of the PSIs came to him and said, mate, you're too high profile. Everybody knows who you are. We'd love to carry on, and it's great. It's been great for the lads to work with you, but it just is not going to work because you everybody knows your face.
I guess we should point out we were doing a lot of work in Northern Ireland then, weren't we? And
well, 2-1 wasn't. The reality of it is that a reservist can work for the British government in war zones. It's a fallacy that TA soldiers don't serve overseas. They do. And in the old days, you used to be able to take what was called an S-type engagement, which basically meant you were temporarily made a regular soldier. And so you became, like in the Gulf War, there was plenty, trust me, there was more than reservists than you would imagine serving in the Gulf. And there was more reservists serving during the Bosnia campaign. I know people don't think this. I know reservists don't, regulars don't like it, but that's true. The truth is the British Army cannot function without its reservist element. That's a fact. It's a pure fact. And under recently, what the changes, the British Army more than ever cannot function without its reserves. So 2-1 had a role which was in Europe in those days, which is probably a matter of public knowledge now, but if you've ever heard the expression gladius or any gladio or any of those operations where left behind troops were spread all out over, you know, Europe to take on the Russians from behind, that's what their role was. So it's changed a bit now. So, but Lou was a British, you know, housewife's favourite. And so he was just too high profile. He told me that himself. And to be honest with you, I think he took it on the chin. I don't think he was bitter about it. You know, I think he was kind of like, I get it. I understand, you know. So that's the story that Lou told me. I mean, I'm sure there's plenty of other people out there that are going to come up with, oh, he's wrong, that's not the whatever. I can only tell you what Lewis Connors told me himself.
Yeah, I sympathise with him because, did I tell you, I didn't get in the SAS.
Yes, you did say that, yeah. But, you know, but it is, a lot of it is about if your face fits. And you can ask Rusty this. You can ask any of the boys this. There's a lot of personal, choices are made about who they think. The whole, have you ever heard the expression, the grey man?
Well, that's a very often quoted term, isn't it, with respect to getting into the SAS?
Or the intelligence corps. Being the grey man, don't get noticed.
Yeah.
Don't get noticed. And, yeah, being the grey man for the regiment is very important, but it's also true for in Corps and various what is now the Special Reconnaissance Regiment. I mean, that thing, be the grey man, don't stand out, and don't. Well, Lou stood out. He was fit, I can tell you that. Lou was a very, very fit man.
Yes, it's also, I think, what we don't realise about celebrity, especially in this sort of X Factor culture where you can be a hairdresser one day and next day you're a number one selling artist, is these folks, they've done this from a very young age. They're incredibly talented, aren't they? Most actors, if you put them in an opera or a theatre or music, they can sing, they can dance, they can do impressions. They're quite funny. They have can we say they're in touch with their feminine self, which I say is a positive thing. And yet here's this guy that's got all these qualities that I've just mentioned, but also that he can smash it out with the SAS.
I respect him for trying. I really do. I respect anybody that tries. And I respect anybody that's gone through any of the basic training and have put themselves into the firing line. I think we all do it for various reasons, and for me it was looking back at a family tradition. I didn't really have much choice to just volunteer. It was one of those things. But is sometimes is maligned, but for most people that knew him and knew why he did it, I think we all have respect for him.
Yes, I'm wearing my Adidas top in homage to Lou today, because pretty sure he wore one of these in the professionals. He always was quite cool. So
I can tell you this, who dares wins. And I know this from people I lived in California now for, you know, I have homes in a couple of places, but I lived in California for 25 years. I still do. And obviously, you know, many people in law enforcement and in the intelligence business, their security business, who dares wins was studied. By everything from the intelligence community to law enforcement in terms of the psychology of it, the techniques. I know SWAT cops that studied it for the use of the flashbangs, which in those days were completely a new distraction devices. So the whole thing of MP5, I'll say his name, Phil Singleton, who was Mr. SAS MP5 representative around the world. A lot of people were like, no, that everything from the weapons to the tactics to the psychology of the Stockholm syndrome, everything was used in that film, was studied by people in the business.
Wow. How well, guys, you can go so deep. I love these conversations. How well was the film received?
Well, it was kind of a mixed bag, because I think, again, and I don't need to defend this, it was a film of its time. If you recall, there was a big thing because Margaret Thatcher did two things that were sort of, you know, very British. One was sending the task force down to reclaim the Falklands Islands, and the other was obviously the Iranian embassy siege. And it was a tough decision to make, but it was the right decision to make, and everybody got behind it and went, whoa. So that was one of the reasons that the film was made. And it wasn't meant to be jingoistic in the sense of, you know, it was meant to follow on from a film called The Wild Geese. The producer that produced Uday's Winds also produced Wild Geese. And so it was supposed to be that, you know, a type of film that appealed to a type of audience at a certain time, which it did. And you've got to see it from that point of view. Although you got a lot of stick because for some reason they apparently used a CND sign during some of the filming of The Crowd. At the beginning of the film, there was various signs, peace signs that we used. And I don't think the writer, George Markstein, who I met, who also wrote The Prisoner, and I can bore for Britain about The Prisoner, intended it to be a slight on CND or the peace movement. It was actually meant to be the symbol of the disrespect for the peace movement by people that were trying to use it for different reasons. So it was to show the juxtaposition of the peace movement against the idea that we should be able to defend ourselves and Britain should be able to defend democracy. So it wasn't having a go at CND. It was trying to say the other side of this, that the argument is that you can have peace, and as long as you are be prepared to defend yourself, that's great. But if you disarm us, we can't defend ourselves. You will get abused. And so I think that was part of the message that George was trying to say in the film. And it got twisted into, no, we're bashing CND, which we weren't at all.
How did how did the SAS take this film? Do they take it as legendary? Was it scoffed at? How was it at the time?
I think the best review is by Rusty Thurman, who went through the film, the techniques, the actual house clearing techniques that are practiced at the Killing House, are pretty spot on, actually. And don't forget, these are the days where running around with a respirator, an S6 respirator, and a Browning eye power. This was all revolutionary stuff. It had never been seen before. And the use of flashbangs and distraction devices that were first used in Mogadishu, I believe, taken out by the regiment to this concept of having a distraction device, the flashbangs, that was all new stuff. It had never been done before. And it was a tremendous risk. The actual raid itself, people go, yeah, but it was so well planned and all that kind of stuff. It could have been, but there was a lot of unknowns, and the unsung heroes in that situation were actually the negotiator. I've met Trevor Locke. I've talked to Trevor Locke. So I know what the situation was inside the actual embassy. And the actual VZ-63, not the Scorpion, but the other Czech machine gun that one of the guys had, I've handled that weapon. So there was a lot of risks that were taken in terms of, and the regiment carried off that raid brilliantly. So I think the film itself was seen as the techniques and everything were seen as pretty spot on. And at the end of the day, Lou did go to Hereford and did go to the Killing House with Ian Sharp, and they studied the techniques and put it into the film. So there's a lot of stuff in there that people go, like even the wall imploding where we end up being shot. I got shot in the house in the Mews. That where they implode the wall, you can talk about whether it was physically possible to do that or not. But the removal of the bricks to put in the listening devices, again, I know where those actual listening devices are. That was all real. They actually did that. They actually removed the bricks so they could get listening devices through the walls so they knew where people were. So there was a lot of it technically, which was spot on.
Yes, it's interesting. I read a fair bit about the SAS, the formation of the SAS, Colonel Maine, so yeah, Paddy Maine. I'm not a warmonger, and I think there's better ways, let's say, but I do like reading the old military stuff because I like real life. I like to spend if I'm going to read, I want to read real life stuff because there's so much exciting stuff out there. And I did read somewhere that a significant proportion of SAS operations go tits up, basically, which if you think of the nature of what these men are willing to do, they're all willing to not come back, aren't they? Which is a brave thing in itself. And by this, I refer to all of our armed forces. But the embassy, my gosh, it all could have gone so wrong, couldn't it? I mean, there were things that didn't go to plan. They say no plan survives first contact
with the enemy.
We had the guy hung up on the rope, which was just unexpected. He's but on fire on a rope. When that charge went off in the famous BBC clip, almost looked like it took the guys out, and then it was a significant amount of time before they got back in through that window. Certainly enough time to execute most of the hostages. And again, I mean, there's no disrespect. I'm just saying that it could have had a very different outcome, couldn't it?
Well, one of them, as we know, had an RDG-5 Russian hand grenade, which he didn't pull the pin on. It wasn't until later on that he was coming down the stairs that one of the lads saw that he had a grenade and whacked him on the back of the head with his MP5. And then he was shot because he was trying to pull the pin out. But if he'd have pulled that pin out in the room where the hostages were, as soon as he heard that first bang, there would have been lots more dead hostages. And he just didn't do it. We will never know why. You know, we don't know why. I think I know why, because, again, I got some insights from Trevor Locke about his battle with Aoun, the number one terrorist at the back, when the guy put his foot through the window. And a lot of that is to do with the Stockholm syndrome. And anyway, if he'd have pulled the pin on that grenade, which we know he had, or they'd have picked up the little submachine gun that they had and decided to execute people, it would have been a very different story.
Yes, and yes, very much so. And I've had Robin...
Horsfall.
Yeah, Robin Horsfall's been on the podcast, I think, three times now. And he was one of the chaps at the bottom of the stairs that put some rounds into this unfortunate gentleman. And also, we're going to get Rusty, well, as you know, because we've both just been speaking to him, but he's going to come on soon. And he's quite aware as to... the defence landscape, let's say, where we're heading as Europe. So I'm keen to probe him there. But back to the film, Mark. what were there any bloopers on it? Were there stuff that went wrong? Were there any accidents? It was quite. Were there any service personnel that did the stunts, or is that all taken care of by stuntmen?
No, there were advisors from the regiment on the set.
I said I did a blooper. I said stuntman. You're not allowed to say that anymore. It's stunt persons
or stunt performers. There were people on the set and hanging around. Let's put it that way. Usually in the bar, but where I was with other people who were serving with the regiment at the time. That is true. They put anonymous at the end of the film, so I won't name them for various reasons. But there were people involved. And as I say, Lou did go to Hereford and was guested around and shown some of the techniques. So there was a certain amount of cooperation with the filming. Although the stunt team themselves was run by a guy called Bob Simmons. Bob was one of the original James Bond stunt coordinators, and he coordinated the action, per se, in the you know, little bits of stunts that we did. And obviously, we had the choppers, Ministry of Defence lend us the little scout helicopters. There was a couple of times when things got hairy, particularly up in Snowdonia when we were filming the scene, because I was up there with Lou during that period. Ian had got them on the edge of a cliff, and Maurice Roeves, who is the officer that jumps out of the helicopter, wow, that chopper pilot, I believe his name was John Cowie, but there was actually more than one chopper pilot. But anyway, the weather was atrocious, and how he managed to hold that Skype, that scout helicopter, on that edge, I don't know. He did a tremendous skill. And I remember they only tried it twice again because Ian was like, we don't need to, we're not trying this again. And Morris almost fell out of the helicopter. He almost fell out of it. And he told me afterwards in the bar, he said, I was terrified. He said, literally, because he suffers from vertigo, he thought he was just going to fall out. So he was riding the skin, hanging on, and he was literally hovering above, trying to land this helicopter in this gale, and basically fell out of the helicopter. And we got away with it, though. But other than the actor that got his nose broken during the interrogation scene by accident, Lou landed a punch on somebody, it was a pure accident. There was nothing about it. He just clunked the guy in the wind, and he had a big hood over his head. And you can look, if you look carefully, you can see the difference in the body shape of the guy in the hood and the smock. Other than that, really, there wasn't really any damage. There was nobody injured seriously.
I'm just going to chip in here, Martin, say for friends at home, if you haven't seen this film and you'd like to, I'm going to put a link below this video where you can buy the DVD. So treat yourself, have a Saturday night in, and watch this classic. Friends, thank you for listening to the Bought the T-Shirt podcast. Please like, subscribe and share. And don't forget to follow me on social media. Username, Chris Thrall. Instagram, Chris.Thrall. Thank you.